respect to the light. So the way we define orientation angle is by looking at the polarity axis in the direction of the future rhizoid, which is where the protrusion forms. And we calculate the angle that this axis makes with respect to the horizontal, which is perpendicular to the direction of the light. So all the spores which have their rhizoids pointing towards the light source will have an orientation angle less than 180. And if the rhizoids is away and the apical side is towards the light source, then the orientation angle would be greater than 180. Yes?
At the moment of niche axis?
What?
What axis?
What do you mean?
Like, how do you find the axis?
Okay, so you find the centroid, and then you find the tip.
Oh.
And then, yeah. That's in this polar plot, you can see that. So, okay, over here, the radius represents the fraction of polarized spores. And then the angle represents the orientation angle. And you can see that most of the spores have their apical side closer to the light source and the basal side away from the light source. And what's also interesting is that the orientation angle is in a very definite range. Like, it does not span all the way from 0 to 180, but it's restricted to this small region here. Yes?
Have you ever seen two axes of polarity, or it's always one?
You will see some of that. Not in this data set. In this data set, it was always one. Okay. So we then wanted to have a look at how the wavelength of light affected how these spores polarized. So for this, our experimental setup, we had a line of diodes along one side, which we had colors of red, green, blue, and white light. And we measured the spectrum which each of those produced, using spectrometer at the top there, and the spectrums are on the right-hand side here. We then placed our box containing our samples, like what Sapna had in the previous experiments, in front of the diodes, and then we contained that in another box to keep out all the external light. So here are some examples of the types of polarization that we then saw. So on the left-hand side, we've got white, and as Sapna had shown before, we've got development here of the rhizoid we saw, and here we do see some outgrowth develop, which are not rhizoids, and some which remain round as well. Under blue light, a far greater proportion of the spores remained round. We saw the occasional one, which had some indication of polarization. Under green light, we saw quite a number of quite long outgrowths. But an interesting feature here is that the outgrowths are in the opposite direction to the sort of rhizoids that we're seeing developing here. But we believe that these are a different type of outgrowth, that this is an apical outgrowth from the main cell rather than the development of a rhizoid. And you can tell that from looking at these images, because you can just about make out here that the chloroplasts, so there's a difference, I guess, intensity maybe to the image to what you're seeing here, where you don't see any chloroplasts in this the lower bit of the developed rhizoid. And then with the red light, we saw many different outgrowths in many different directions. That's sort of an overview, but of course we then wanted to actually quantify this. And so to do this, we segmented our images. From that, we could then calculate a major axis by looking at the boundary and finding the two points which were furthest apart from each other. And then, at this stage, you can then calculate an angle based on the orientation of this major axis. But this then doesn't distinguish, this just says whether the polarization is in line with the light source, but it doesn't distinguish between whether the polarization is with the light source or against the light source. We also at that stage then considered, so we have our major axis. You can then identify a bounding box aligning with that major axis, which then gives you a second distance in the opposite direction, and from which you can define an aspect ratio to get an idea of how round these spores are at any stage. We then thresholded to restrict the to bigger spores where you've got a more developed rhizoid, and then you can then have a look at looking along the major axis. You can bisect the major axis and look at which half of the spore is then bigger. And the expectation is because the rhizoid is developing, or the outgrowth is developing as a thinner outgrowth, that should have the smaller area compared to the main body of the cell. So now you've identified which end the rhizoid, or the outgrowth, I'm going to call it, is on. You can now define a 360-degree angle, which will now detect whether the outgrowth is towards the light or away from the light. And since people mentioned it, I should say that this thresholding value does mean that some small rhizoids are just thrown out because the aspect ratio isn't high enough. So, first let's consider then the angle of the spores, of the major axis of the spores. So this is now from the left-hand side, this is just to remind you. So 0 degrees would be aligning horizontally, 90 degrees would be aligning with the major axis with the light, but that's with the light or against the light, and then 180 is back to horizontal again. So with white light, small aspect ratios, which would be sort of fairly round spores, we see quite a variation in angle. But as the spores get longer, which is what we'd expect to correlate to a more well-developed outgrowth, rhizoid or apical outgrowth, we are seeing more alignment with the direction of light. When we applied blue wavelength, most of the, all the spores all have relatively low aspect ratio, they're still relatively round, and there's quite a variation in the angle of alignment. We then move down to green. We see a much longer aspect ratio, which we expect, which suggests that the outgrowths are bigger relative to the spore. And we are seeing, again, indication of alignment with that direction, with the vertical axis, so with the direction of light, with or against the light. And then with red, we see, you know, a range of aspect ratios, but still quite a range of angles in terms of even at higher aspect ratios in terms of the alignment. Yes?
Do you think that the response to blue light is due to cell toxicity?
I don't know. We didn't consider that. I think all I can really say from what we saw is that there was not a lot of change, not much happened.
Were they smaller? The population would be smaller.
I think for that we would need to do a dark control and compare, which we haven't done because the dark control was done under different conditions, not under the diode. Yes, that's right. Yes.
The green is really remarkable to me. I mean, that you're growing from this other end.
Like, yeah.
You know, from, well, actually, I don't know very much about Marcantia spores, but the way the very small amount of textbook is like you grow a rhizoid, it comes out this end, and this is going to make the part that grows and becomes the the anchoring part. So, what on earth is this other thing coming out the other end?
I'm told you can sometimes see this under sort of dark conditions, so it's all trying to grow towards whatever light there is and trying to find a more light, I guess. So, I think this sort of thing can occur.
And is that because also on the other, it's not entirely true, but in general, green light is supposed to be the thing that plants don't really use. The signaling uses red and blue, and so is green. Is it interpreting this as like, oh, this is dark?
How's your spectrum of light? It's not completely green.
Yes, sir.
There's a
paper. Yeah, so you can see that here, so, I mean, yes, there is some variation, but it's not bad.
The Marcantia might be different, right? Like, what we are talking about is, quite sort of,
So these photons presumably interact with the plant, right? So do you know the absorption spectrum of that plant? If you shine just white light at it, what kind of light comes through? Did you measure that?
Yes, we do know, but and it's pretty similar to every other plant. There's nothing special here. I wasn't going to say anything, but the green light effect is an etiolation effect. So what that means is it's not affecting the polarization of the smoke per se, but this is their result. So maybe we should leave this till the end because they've thought about some of this.
So that was just looking at whether the spores had demonstrated some level of alignment with the light. But if we now have a look actually in terms of the 360 degree angle and whether it's aligning, you know, with the light or against the light, we've got white light on the end. So this is now for about 22 spores, and the little pictures around the side will indicate the direction the spores are facing at that angle, and we can see the largest region is when the spores are aligned so that the apical end is towards the light source with the rhizoid pointing away, and we can then compare that to the red where it's now we see these outgrowths in all different directions in comparison.
And also I think when Stefan was showing the data, the same thing too, where in the white light, if you make a mistake, kind of, like not grow away from the, I don't know if that's a mistake, but if you're not growing away, you're growing towards. It's not like it's spreading out to the sides at all. It looks like they're, is that true?
Well, I think some of this may be it's detecting an apical outgrowth rather than a rhizoid. I think that is a problem with this computational method. If I had another week, that would probably be the next step, is to try and distinguish between the two. So it could be a bit of that. But I think we saw some rhizoids growing in sort of others' directions, but I guess they haven't really got long enough to compensate, so I don't know whether they would grow up and come back down again, but they haven't got very far at this stage, so...
That's why you call it polarity, not the germination. Yeah, okay.
So I've now left the white for comparison on the left and changed, so we've now got the green on the right, and we can see here that the outgrowth is almost in the opposite direction to what we saw with the white light, which we think is a result of it being apical outgrowth rather than a rhizoid. And this nice picture does sort of distinguish between the two, where you can see the apical outgrowth here with all the chloroplasts. This is where the cell division occurred, and then you've got the rhizoid developing here. So the conclusions from the wavelength experiment was that for the green light, we do see with the outgrowths which are growing towards the light. With the red light, we do see so rhizoids develop and polarization, but it doesn't seem to align particularly in any direction. And then with the blue light, we see minimal amounts of polarity at all. So I'll pass back to you, Settler. Okay. So next we looked at the third question that Raj mentioned, which is, what is the timing of this polarity specification? And the way we chose to address this is by changing the direction of light as the cell is making its decision to polarize. So we use the same setup that I mentioned earlier. Spores in agar in dark box and then exposed to light. But then at different time points, we move the light source to the opposite face of the sample. In an ideal world, you would like to move the light source. But for now, we actually physically rotated the sample to achieve a similar effect. And then measured if the polarity, what is the polarity with respect to the old light. And this is just a reminder that the orientation angle would be less than 180 if the rhizoid is towards the light source, and greater than 180 if the rhizoid is away from the light source. And this is what we see in the wild type, where you have only one light source. So what happens if you change the direction of light source in 5 hours of old light? So this was pretty cool. So over here, you can clearly see that in the sample which had a new light source, or which had a change in direction of light source at 5 hours, some spores actually, no, most of the spores respond to the new light source in that their polarity is reversed compared to the control where there was no change in light direction. Yes?
You say it was spores that first polarize more and then rotate, or is it different spores?
Wait, say that again?
Is it the same spore that did polarize in one direction and rotated?
So all of this data is done in fixed tissues. But the spores are embedded in agar. I don't know how much freedom of movement is there. So if I were to guess, I would say not. But ideally, you would like to do a live cell imaging of spores while they are making this polarity decision. Yes.
Does this transition change, or the efficiency of this transition change, if you do it a little later? The reorientation?
That's the next slide. Oh, yes.
Yeah, maybe to kind of answer Laura's question as well. So if you just looked at something after 5 hours of light, would there even be any outgrowth to measure?
No.
No. I will refer back to the initial development of the spores that Raj mentioned to relate these results to what the spore looks like at 5 hours and what's happening here. Okay. So, Sebastian's question. What if you do the same experiment at later time points? You see a very time-dependent effect, which was striking, in the sense that if you change the direction of light at 18 hours, there are some spores which still respond to the new light. Well, I guess I shouldn't make that statement because the fraction of spores looks similar in both the cases. But anyways, one thing is clear that at later time points, the spores preferentially respond to the old light source and don't respond to the new light source, which is different from what we saw for the 5 hour time point. So what's, yes?
So does the, so do you see the symmetry response when you like have the first light source, so you shine the first light source for 5 hours and then 19 versus 5. Does like first the first direction has an effect on this thing?
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
So it's like, is it the duration of light that you shine that is important, or is like the fact that the first get to this light?
Duration of light. What was the second thing you said?
Or like whether you shine this direction of light first as opposed to this direction of light.
Yeah, so this experiment suggests that the direction matters, right? Because in this case, the spores are receiving 48 hours of light from the same direction. And in this case, they receive 5 hours of light in one direction, and then the rest 43 hours of light from the opposite direction.
I guess the question is, you switch those light patterns. So you shine like 43 hours from the bottom first, and then
okay.
You shine 5 hours from the top first. Do you think that the pattern will reverse?
Yes, based on this, I would say that. Because over here, what's happening is you shine this for 18 or 24 hours, and then for the remaining 48 minus 18 or 48 minus 24 hours, you do this. And what you're seeing is that the polarity pattern is more like the wild type. So the longer you expose the spores to the... So you can imagine like spores in direction one, direction two. So it looks like if the longer you expose, no, I wouldn't say it's only the duration, because it's also, I mean, it's difficult to uncouple duration and timing here. I'll get back to you. Yes.
So will you explain a little better what you mean by reorientation as opposed to orientation?
Oh, sorry. This is actually not precise. This is just, we used to call it reorientation experiment. So while making the slide, it just was left there. But the way I did these experiments was, so you have the sample, which is the slide in this box in the direction of light. And then at different time points, which is 5, 18, or 24, I take out that sample and then rotate it 180 degrees so that the opposite face is facing the light.
So reorientation refers to
this process.
Reorienting the box.
This, yeah.
Going back to rhizoid, so you can imagine scoring the fraction of spores that polarize after 1 hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, 7 hours, right? And then, so an obvious thing that comes to mind is that the ones that didn't polarize before 5 hours are the ones
that are responding to for the next light. Yes. Yeah, that I think that's a reasonable explanation. Yes. So
when you see these spores, germinated one, it's never like they don't do the U-turn of the growth.
Oh, sorry, say that again. You turn off.
So first they start growing against the first direction, and then they grow. Like when you switch the right direction, they go.
Oh, okay.
So
they
don't move, but they change the direction of the tube.
Well, in the first 48 hours, we don't see that. If you remember the confocal image, at 72 hours, it started to, bend.
Okay.
I don't know after 72 hours it might go up or down, but
so that might not be able to happen too, so that there are different timing and different response to
So this is the slide that Raj showed in the very beginning. And you can see that within the first 5 hours, the cells are not doing much in the sense that they don't really have a chloroplast and they look more similar to the 0 hour time point than 18 hour time point. So I would say based on this that within the first 5 hours, spores are not visibly polarizing. I mean, it's all very, not very precise, I agree. But one obvious difference between these 5 and 18 hour time points is the presence of chloroplast. So it might be that the cells are making this polarity decision during or after they get some chloroplast. Like that was my thought. It might be wrong completely.
So following up on that, do you think that if you just grew them in regular light everywhere, checked when they started to make chloroplasts, and then gave them light for 5 hours one direction, and then switched it, do you think that they would switch to the new direction then? Or they'd stick to the...
I would say, like, if they are, they've started to make... I am currently thinking that there is some correlation between photosynthesis or making of chloroplasts and development of polarity. So that would be a good experiment to test that, if that's actually what's happening.
But doesn't the result indicate that there's something happening in the first 5 hours, right? Because if I remember correctly, after the first 5 hours, you switch to the other direction. Right, but still a significant fraction oriented towards the old light?
Some fraction, yes.
Right, so something was happening, right?
Yeah, but also
but
this is...
nothing was visible.
Also this... Oh, where is that image? I'm showing this for just what one's pore, so it'll be good to see what's actually going on in these pores that are responding to new light and what's going on in this pores that are responding to old light. And then we can parse out the chloroplast correlation. Okay, so this is one thing. Another interesting data that we got from this 18-hour reorientation is not a good word, but the samples that were moved, rotated at 18 hours, was that some spores developed rhizoids on both the sides. So this is weird, but it's also interesting in the sense that this apical cell, so what this is telling you is this: there was a spore which responded to the first light direction by undergoing an asymmetric division, by forming a rhizoid opposite to the direction of the light source, and then you change the direction, change the light source, and then this apical cell divided again to form another rhizoid in opposite direction. And that does not usually happen because this apical cell does not usually undergo two asymmetric divisions within 48 hours. So we thought this would be something interesting to follow up on in the future. But for now, So far, our results suggest that spores grow and polarize in direction to light, in response to light, and that they're making this polarity decision somewhere between 5 and 18 hours. And I'll hand over to Alfie for the rest. Yes?
Is there any way to chemically or... chemically treat or just treat in general the spores so that they polarize all at the same time? Like, is there a way to synchronize polarization?
So you're saying that they're not doing it, like the response is variable across in the population. I don't know if I can, I don't know what to do to get that.
Yeah. But the chemicals, we need to target some mechanism. We don't even know what are the mechanisms involved. So once we don't know mechanisms, we don't know what are the chemicals that might stop or anything. So maybe we need to look at the mechanisms first, and then...
So I guess another way to rephrase it is, do you think this delay in polarizing or creating this outgrowth for the rhizoid is genetically controlled?
I can't rule that out.
That's true.
Yes.
Are you going to talk about photoreceptors at some point?
Going to talk about any receptors.
Do you have any guesses? I mean, the green hue seems to be kind of curious. I guess photoreceptors known mainly blue and red.
Right.
I don't know.
Usually, when these spores are plated in suboptimal light conditions, they seem to produce this epithelial outgrowths. And in the green light condition, what we are seeing could be a perception of suboptimal light, like the plant is trying, no, the spore is trying to find light. Because this we see.
But wasn't it directional? Wasn't it directional?
Yeah, it was directional.
So,
but maybe if it can't use it, it's like it didn't get any light.
Okay, but what about the red result? Didn't that, that was seemed to be more like, no, that seemed to be
so
more like responses than otherwise.
So what we know is like, the penetration of red wavelength is much higher because we are using agar, right?
Yeah.
And the penetration of red wavelength is higher compared to the blue. And it could be one reason why most of the spores received enough photons, which allowed them to polarize in multiple directions. While the blue light, as you can see, most of them didn't. So it could be also one reason that why in red light we get multiple directions. These are things to be verified, right? And during the course, we could also get a chance to do a real geneticist's view of doing biology. And the beauty of this model organism is that the spores are haploid, which implies the spores have only one copy of their chromosomes, and most of the genes are like single copy genes. So any mutants, you can right away screen it for in the first generation itself. And to give away a number, just an example, like we did mutagenesis for around like 600,000 spores at once. So which would be a hectic job if we are sticking together to any other model organism. So we used UV transilluminator, which we use for the DNA gels to create the mutants, and we plotted a depth curve for the different doses of UV illumination, and we could see that around 52 seconds of UV illumination we get like half death rate. So we took two different time points, like one just below the 50 range, which is 45 seconds, and one above, which is 1 minute. And just before going into detail, I would like to introduce you to the wild type 7-day-old organism. And it has mainly two different parts. So the green chloroplast rich part is the one which is above, which is formed from the apical stem cell. And this apical stem cell, it divides both in the horizontal and vertical directions to produce this apical cell mass, which grows towards the direction of light, which is chloroplast rich, while the whitish structure here, which is formed from the terminally differentiated single-celled rhizoid, and it's a root-like structure which grows away from light, right? And now we have the mutants, and for the purpose of nomenclature, we just named them as our team name. And so to check the efficiency of the mutagenesis, we first score for some very common mutants of Mercantia, which are for Spolas 1, you can see that most of the cells are whitish or colorless, which is called albino mutant. And Spolas 2 and Spolas 3, you can see the rhizoids are small and curly, which is also a typical mutant derived. Yeah. They still polarize. Yeah, this is not, like we can see, I don't know if we can really differentiate between rhizoid or because we were using chloroplast as a measure to differentiate between rhizoid and apical cell. If you don't see that, I don't know how to differentiate between, like, how functionally they are different. So.
Are you sure there is no chloroplast? It's not just
a less number, because I can see some green.
I mean, you're saying there is a chloroplast when you see the green,
yeah,
round little things, right? There could be
chlorophyll. Yeah, it's not chloroplast, chlorophyll. Yeah. And interestingly, we could see a mutant, which is Pollas 4, where the green apical structures are there, which without any rhizoid-like structures, so it could be a rhizoidless mutant. And we could also see a mutant where there is long elongated apical cell kind of structure. And what we suppose is that, like, in this mutant, there was like a problem with the cell division orientation. And we know that in the apical cell, the cell division can happen both in the horizontal and vertical plane. But in this mutant, we can see that the cell division happens only in one direction. So what might have gone wrong here could be something related to the cell division polarity. And we have one more mutant where it does not have both rhizoids and is an albino. So yeah, these are a few examples of the mutants. So to conclude...
Sorry. Maybe I'm being dumb here, but how would you recover any of these mutants? Are they all lethal?
So, we have to wait to see if they can create spores, because there are some mutants which are made, for example, the row of plants. We have a mutant for that. So, if the adult survives and if you get the spores, we can score for the mutation and, yeah.
Maybe that's also a general question, because clearly there'd be really interesting things that are lethal. So is there a trick that you can make things temporarily diploid or something like that if there was something that was lethal?
Actually, there is a transient phase of this plant, this organism, which goes through diploid phase, which is the sporophyte phase. That is diploid, and from the sporophytes, haploid spores are produced. So I don't know if we can try to... We should get the mutant spores first, then we can...
It's along a similar line, right? Can you isolate conditional mutants?
Yeah, like or temperature sensitive or some resistance, mm-hmm, kind of mutants, yeah. That can be also possible. I have to. I thought.
Is there, and this could be a general question for your group and also for the other people who work on Mercantia, do you have a barcode system similar to what they have in Chlamydomonas where you can kind of grow up clones and then do a mutagenesis and then see which clones disappear?
Like.
Yeah. Like,
classic.
Yeah.
Bacterial mutagenesis.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like that.
I know.
No.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So to conclude, we have shown that Mercantia spores can respond to light and grow in respect to light, and they orient their polarity axis in the direction of light, and these spores tend to respond to different wavelengths differently. And We know that, like, to the red light, the spores can orient their axis randomly, while to blue light, the spores don't divide. But I think we have seen few spores which are divided, but they orient their axis towards the light. So that's one observation. And with green light, the spores don't divide. They tend to just elongate their apical cell. And we have also seen a temporal correlation of this polarity axis determination versus the amount of light they have received in particular direction. So like at 18 hours, if the spores have received 18 hours of light, and if their light axis is reoriented, we can see like double rhizoid conditions, while just before or just after, we don't see that. So it suggests that the polarity axis determination has a like a very time specific. Yeah, it's very time specific. And as future work, we would like to optimize the protocol for live imaging of the spore development. We gave few trials, but we were not that successful to keep them alive on a confocal system. And it would allow us to use like some of the transgenic lines developed in labs for different protein components. And then we wanted to characterize the response of the spores to different light features like intensity or the frequency of or pulses of light like that. And we would like to optimize the optogenetic platform to use for tuning these light features from different directions. For example, like to send blue light from one direction and red light from the opposite and see how these spores respond, for example. And we have obtained few mutants from the UV mutagenesis screen. It would be good if we have more time, we would like to like characterize these mutations and see if we can score for some mutants which are like affecting the polarity determination pathway. And to the end, we would like to propose a mathematical model that can eventually explain the symmetry breaking event in Mercantia spores. With that, we would like to thank our team leaders, Hugh, Radka, and Liam, for giving us an opportunity to work with them and for being with us during all the difficulties. We would like to thank Sebastian for running around for booking all those microscopy platforms and image analysis platform. And we would like to thank Eileen for like providing resources at right time. And we would like to thank all the funding agencies and especially KITP for organizing such a nice workshop for like young researchers like us. So, and thank you all for listening to us.
Of time, we should just move on to the next group because we're really running behind. Well, how about 5 minute break? Right? Yes, that's what it is.
You measure that on the project. Or do this on the project.
So you can
even
So I think what's interesting is
but then you have a metric, so you measure your unit.
Nothing is happening early on. But
that's more like exactly the opposite way. What happens in nature?
So this is in 12 hours. So it's different than 12 hours.
What it has to do is it has to measure this guy here.
And this is what it's doing, right? And so you do an integral over 12 hours. That's what you do.
The source of light moves. Right.
That's what I'm saying, right? So
I didn't want to say what you said in your statement.
No, but also the
interesting thing is, in the object, you can get infinity, and And when you did this measurement right? of
so, so polarization, basically, using the random transform, yes.
you did it on the pullback, right? And the transformation is such that I'm not too familiar, I mean, I studied the basics of differential geometry.
So get the,
is it open all the time?
What they did is they basically started mining for cryptocurrency, and then the computer got shut down, right? That's why they couldn't finish their analysis. And then the other thing, I mean, okay, I know it's with you guys, right? And then the other thing is that
I hope we have to find out.
Nice.
No, you did very well.
I think you could probably even get polygon signs because there's like some cool stuff in Python that lets you like approximate a nearest polygon. You have to kind of fit it, but then you get real edge links and stuff like that. I guess a circle might look like an N-gon.
Yeah, right.
So then you would really just want, but if you could get the polygon, then you could ask about change in angles.
Whereas if you don't,
then it's just a little bit left, right, you're changing your angle by whatever, 90 degrees every pixel.
Yeah, there might be an easy way to do it. You could also look at convexity by creating it. So you have essentially like a skeleton, right, with a wall.
Yeah.
So there's, or you can rig up to find like a change in the normal vector, which would also be when you try to change a sign, then you'd probably get the same thing.
Yes.
But it might be faster than you
I don't know.
Oh.
I think the point is that the segmentation works well.
That works.
And so they expected this all by the operator on the membrane. It's weak, but I'll show the fit.
Do you expect it to be easier or is it a weak?
No, it's better to try it.
We did.
Yes, it is.
and then I grouped in four. But other than that, I'm free. I might skip. Okay. Yeah, sounds good. And slack me if I don't slack you. Five, two, or something. I would just make a scene.
Oh, dispatch.
Yeah, dispatch.
Okay.
In that case, I can show you how to do this.
You already have data?
And is it the police passing or is it the police being charged?
I don't have my phone in this pocket.
But we make fun of our
phones. Is it okay to have
phone?
Hey, I like to have a phone.
Yeah.
So one would have to basically.
Hi everyone. We're Team Leaf, and we're gonna talk about pattern formation in Arabidopsis leaves. Before I begin our presentation, I want you to take a look at this beauty of microscopic picture. This is a true leaf growing out of the meristem, and Mindy was able to get this from the confocal in the QBio lab. So we've heard a lot about morphogenesis during these 5 weeks, and our temporary favorite model organism during these 2 weeks was Arabidopsis leaves. And as you can see, they grow, and as a non-plant biologist, what's most fascinating to me is that these cells don't actively rearrange themselves. They just kind of grow overall together and then divide, but somehow they're able to achieve this pattern. You have these pavement cells that are kind of like lobi, and you make stomata that serve as a mouth of the plant. And you see that they are somewhat evenly spaced from each other, and they are not really touching. So the main question was, how does this pattern emerge and establish during development? So stoma in Greek means mouth, and as I mentioned, stomata is the mouth of the plant. It allows you to exchange gas and water. And the cells that comprise the stomata, it's called guard cells. They actually come from the cells that enter this stomata lineage. And the ones that enter this lineage and don't become the stomata cells will end up become these pavement cells, which are, again, little crazy-looking, little lobe cells. So at the heart of this stomatal patterning is this transcription factor called speechless. And you can guess, I told you that stoma means mouth. If you knock down this gene, you get no stomata, you have no mouth, so you're speechless. thought that would be funny, but. Anyway, if you have a cell that's expressing high level of speechless, it asymmetrically divides, and then in this bigger cell, it actually actively degrades speechless. But the small cell maintains high expression of speechless, which means it retains the ability to asymmetrically divide again. So you can imagine that if this happens multiple times, it'll kind of divide in like a spiral pattern to form this kind of rosette shape geometry of cells. And at some point, this cell decides to commit, and it turns off speechless expression, and it'll turn on this other transcription factor that's called mute. And when that happens, after a few steps, this cell divides symmetrically just once to become the guard cells that make the stomata. So if you change the number of cells that express speechless, you change the number of these stem cell-like cells in the leaf, which eventually affects the stomatal density and the growth of the leaf. So this is a time-lapse movie of growing leaf. That has the transcription factors that I just mentioned. Speechless is in green, mute is in blue, and you can see that a lot of these cells like constantly turn on and off speechless, and some of them commit to become the guard cells. And you see that these are somewhat evenly spaced, and the blue cells aren't really touching with each other. So this is kind of really complicated system. So what would be the first thing that we can do in this time span of 2 weeks? As I mentioned, these plant cells, amazingly, they don't actively rearrange themselves. They don't move. So we can, based on the geometry of the cells, we can kind of backtrack how it would have divided in the past, and maybe how it'll divide later. So we, to be in alignment with the spirit of this course, we thought that, oh, maybe we could develop some algorithm that can quantify the shape, the geometry of the cells. For example, like, what's the size, what's the lobiness, like, what's the shape of the cell, and like, what's the number of cells that each cell is touching. And maybe that'll give us some information on the identity of these cells, or maybe the fate of these cells, what these are going to become later. And I'll toss my turn to Mindy, who will explain our efforts to build this tool. She's actually not here. She recorded a nice video for us. So I'll just...
No.
Wait.
Nice.
Okay.
No. No.
I think it was muted.
We don't have the HDMI video.
Are you plugged into the speakers?
Yes.
The white cord?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Can you select the speaker option?
Yeah.
Here it is.
But it's muted.
For our quantitative analysis, we considered three main types of cells. The first were the pavement cell.
Sorry.
analysis, we considered three main types of cells. The first were the pavement cells, which are large cells responsible for supporting the roof. The next class of cells we considered were the stomata, which actually consists of two guard cells surrounding the pore that allows for the exchange of water and air in the environment. The last class of cells we considered were small, somewhat indistinct cells that we call the vertebrate cells. Now, the story behind this name comes from ornithology, where lots of small birds, such as sparrows, tend to look very similar, except for some tiny margin that if you're not an expert and you're not very close to them, you cannot tell exactly what species it is. Similarly, these cells can be quite variable, even though they all tend to be small. And we didn't know how to identify each of the little types, which will ultimately differentiate into different types of cells in the adult leaf. Hence, little brown bird cells and baby cells. Now, our objects, identification and segmentation tracking, automatically calculated some metrics for these different cell types. For example, we could get the area of these cells and the orientation with respect to the entire image. In addition to these metrics, we decided to calculate the lobiness of cells. So lobiness is a one way to distinguish pavement cells from other types of cells, as these are roughly convex, while leaves have little concave pockets. Our index for lobiness consisted of a ratio between the area of a convex hole of a cell to the area of the cell itself. Now, if this ratio is 1, then the object is convex. If this ratio is less than 1, then we have these concave little pockets. Therefore, we can use lobiness as a threshold to identify pavement cells not bad. In addition to these cell level properties, we decided to consider automatically calculating one metric for spatial distribution, which we will refer to as the clustering index. Now, the clustering index is sometimes used in ecology, particularly population ecology. And the basic idea is that if we have some leaf with some known area, and we know the locations of all of the cells of a particular type that is of interest to us within this leaf, then we can obviously calculate the empirical density of these cells within this leaf. If we now construct a Poisson point process with the same density, then this would represent where we would expect the cells to be if the distribution were completely random. So if we were to now consider any given point in this leaf and look at the distance to the nearest neighbor and repeat this for all points, then we can obtain an empirical distribution for the nearest neighbor distance for our cells of interest. We can next do the same for our Poisson process of equivalent density. If we then take the ratio of the mean of the nearest neighbor distributions, then we can obtain some metric for the clusteredness of these cells in this leaf. In particular, if the metric is less than 1, then we have more clustering. So we might have little patches with a lot of cells and then some distant other patches with more. Whereas if we are completely ordered distribution, then we'll have a metric that is greater than 1. With a perfect societal array producing a clustering index of about 2.
So now that we have learned from Windy how to characterize the different cell types, this is a segmented image with an example of how we've identified the different types of cells, where the green cells are the guard cells, the gray dots represent the pavement cells, and the blue dots represent cells that we don't yet know the identity, which means that they're predominantly the little brown bird cells. And this is a histogram showing the distribution of the index representing lobiness, where the lower the lobiness index, the more likely it is to be a pavement cell. And then we see that the distribution of the lobiness for stomata is around 1, because they are kind of spherical.
What does it mean to have a lobiness greater than 1?
Oh, yeah, we kind of expected this. So we are suspecting that So when we calculate the Venus as an area, ratio of the area, the ratio of the actual cell is taken as a sum of the pixels, but then we use kind of like the center of the pixels of the boundaries to calculate the area of the convex hull.
So it's more like how generated the convex hull, right? Like how generated the convex hull?
I think it's just a like the discretization. But there could be like other reasons. I don't know. Yeah.
Like a technical artifact of
pixelation
of the
images. Yeah. And like a lot of the like in the other cells, a lot of the cells are like much smaller. Yeah, because they are like the little brown bird cells.
So roughly how many pixels do you get per cell?
Maybe
10? Pixels. 10?
Yeah. Like I mean I like there's a wide variation, yeah.
2,000. Around
1,000.
The smallest.
Yeah, the smallest might be. Yeah. Yeah. So now that we can kind of like look at the different cell types, we were interested in understanding what the patterns of these cell types are. And we look at, in particular, we look at how the small cells are distributed across the leaf. So the left figure shows a heat map of the area, where the blue cells are the cells with a smaller area, and the yellow cells are cells with a larger area. And we see that from this distribution that they actually span like a wide range of areas. As we expected, the pavement cells tend to be larger than the stomata and other cell types. And what might be interesting is that we see kind of a higher density of the small cells nearer the leaf base compared to the leaf tip, which there's kind of like a density gradient in the number of, in the small cells. And this is consistent with what is known in literature where the number of cell divisions near the leaf base is much higher, and the cells that are near the tip dilate more. Yeah. Yeah. We are also interested in looking at how these cells are oriented within the whole leaf. And so for every cell, we fitted it to an ellipse, and the red lines just plots the major axes of that ellipse. And we see that the color underlying is still the area that was shown in the previous slide. So the yellow cells are the more or less the pavement cells, and we see that they are very aligned along the leaf axis. Whereas the orientation of the cells in the blue regions are more kind of random. Yeah. And this is like a distribution of the orientation. And yeah, so it'll be kind of interesting to see, to analyze further, to see whether like along about the axis of the leaf, whether like the cells, the small cells on the left side are somehow like a reflection of the small cells on the right side, something like that. Yeah. Oh, hello.
Do I understand correctly that growth is basically a dilation of the entire structure so that it's uniform everywhere, so cells are keeping their shape?
No, so the cells, the pavement cells, change in terms of like how lobby they are over time also.
Oh, they do change.
Yeah, they do change.
But that's just subdivision that sets the polarity of a cell.
No, yeah. But the cell divisions do change the orientation of the cell, as we'll see in the next slide here. But then, later we'll see that the growth is also not uniform across the leaf. Yeah. So these are like zoomed in images of a certain section in the leaf where we can have a closer look at the orientation of the cells. And there's, if we see there's a cell division here, like from here to here, so then the orientation kind of changes from here to like, yeah. as you would kind of expect. Yeah, it would be interesting to like understand more how these division events affect like the overall orientation of like all the cells in the leaf. Yeah. So next, we also wanted to understand the dynamics of this cell division, in particular, like what is the orientation of the new cell wall with respect to, for example, the axis of the cell, and like, for example, is the ratio between the daughter cells regulated? Like, what controls that? And like, there are a lot of like the little brown bird cells everywhere. So what determines like which of them divides first? Like, is it related to like the surroundings of those cells? Yeah, so like which of the daughter cells enter the somatal lineage? And we were also interested in the transient dynamics of the transcription factors, like between divisions, there might be like variation in transcription factors and polarity protein expression, which might tell us something about like the divisions. So in order to do all of these things, we thought that it would be very useful to be able to track the individual cells. So this is what we tried. So over here, this is a leaf, a segmented leaf, where every dot represents the centroid of each of the cell. And then over different time frames, we can kind of like track the centroids. And they are more or less kind of like stable for most of the cells. Yeah, and but like some errors, especially in like the smaller cells. Yeah. So this is an example of, okay, so I'll play this. This is a raw data where we see kind of like divisions occurring. And this is just to show that like we can also see like these divisions are kind of like detected by, like, for example, this cell become like two cells. Yeah, and then this cell become like two cells. And this cell become like two cells. So we can kind of like identify these division events. But this, so I'm only showing like the successful, yes?
Can you just give us an idea of the time scale of the movie?
Oh, every frame is 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the whole movie?
Oh, the total length of this movie is 10 frames, so like 400 minutes. But these are not like consecutive. Like, so the three different divisions occur at different time points. Yeah.
So roughly, what fraction of cells divide over the course of the movie?
I think the division rate is every 12 hours or 24 hours.
But how many cells can you capture in this movie? It's not many.
Oh, like the whole leaf? The number of divisions in the whole
leaf. So that you were able to observe in your movie.
Oh. So the thing is, I didn't manage to like automatically identify all the divisions. Yeah. So by eye I can see like quite a few. But because I tried to automatically identify like divisions, and then like, I'll get like 100 of them, and then I'll look carefully, and like only a very small fraction of them are actually true divisions, because like there are segmentation errors where like they think it's a division but it's actually not. Yeah, so I think like that's a problem that like I think would be very useful to fix in the future if you really want to like study these division events. Yeah.
But so you can say 100 is a upper bound then?
I think so, yeah.
That's like numerator. What's in the denominator? So roughly in the field of view, there are how many cells? 500? Look at the segmentation. How long was there?
400. 400 in the whole leaf.
No.
Eh? No, 4,000.
Thousand.
Yeah, 4,000. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Oh yeah, so because we wanted to like understand look at like the transient dynamics in the cells. So this is an experimental image we took of with both the transcription factors markers, whether, let me play this. So the red markers, these are like speechless, and the green markers are mute. And then, So we can see like interesting events like this, where after a division, the nucleus kind of like moves across the cell. Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to kind of like understand this with respect to like the division plane and things like that. And also like the expression levels of the genes with regards to like the division time. Yeah. Okay, so we were looking at this movie, and then we also see that like the leaf seems to grow more in the width compared to like the length. So then we looked at, so over 400 minutes, we looked at how, we looked at the change. So this plots like the change in area of every cell over 400 minutes. And we see that like the cells here seem to increase more than like the cells here, which is consistent with the fact that it's kind of expanding in the width. So for this, like, I only took a fraction of the movie because I couldn't store like, all the frames in the memory.
Also, in general, the length of the movie is limited by how long can you keep the sequence alive.
Well, that's sort of what I'm asking. Is it the memory side? Keeping it alive?
There are a lot more frames, actually, in this movie than what I...
Defending other groups of local...
That's also part of it. Because, as already mentioned, the plants tend to be relatively slow, so we need to observe the dynamics over a long time. And of course, other groups wanted to image as well, so we needed to coordinate. But primarily, if you know we get unlimited confocal time, then it's how long can you keep the signal alive?
So, yeah. So as we were interested in this stomatal pattern, we also actually, one thing we were really interested in is to understand when, where, and how does stomatal pattern initiate, actually. So it is known in the field, or it's thought in the field, that actually you have, after germination, you will have a little seedling growing, and this is a cotyledon, so like the first leaves kind of the plant. And it's kind of thought that the pattern of the stomata erase at that moment in development. So like the seedling is seen like a blank tissue somehow, and stomata will form like at this moment. So we did look at this seedling very early on, so just right after germination. And you can, I hope you can appreciate on this picture that we actually already see little cells that make us think of these little brown cells. And actually, you don't see it on this image, but for this this leaf, we also had mute. So if you remember from Moon introduction, when the cells turn mute, they are committed to give rise to stomata. So we believe that those little cells that you see here around are actually stomata precursors. So this made us think that, okay, so maybe the pattern is not initiated at that moment, and we need to go back in time during the development and look at the development of this plant. So this is the embryogenesis of Arabidopsis thaliana. So it starts, the embryo here, you can see, starts with these globular stages. It will grow, become heart-like shape. So this is the future cotyledon, and here you will have the root. This elongates and give rise to this torpedo stage. And then the embryo continue growing, but it's actually confined by the seed coat. And so it will make this turn because it's growing in a confined environment. Then it becomes mature. And so while this is happening, the development of the embryo, the seed coat actually will progressively dry out to reach this dormant state where the seeds drastically change size. So in order to actually go out of this dormant stage, the seeds has to experience, most of the time, has to experience germination, what we call germination. This is actually caused by many, many different parameters. And once you pass germination, you can start growing a seedling. So we did look at different stages of development. That's the actual real pictures. We could have Hertz stage images, one actually, and this is thanks to Anne Vatten in Dominique Bergman labs. So we didn't manage to get this stage ourselves, but all the other stages we got, one image per stage. So you have torpedo, mature, post-mature, dormant, and then what we call the activated seeds, that the first image I showed you. It means that we put the seeds in water for 2 days, dark and water. We try to recreate germination. And we know that it kind of worked because we have a movie of this seed, and it developed over time, and as I showed you, it turned on mute.
So to get these out, do you have to like break open the seed?
Yeah, so there is. We were first doing it one by one seeds, and it was quite laborious. But then Paul, another TA, showed us how to do it very easily. Like you put the seed in between two cover slips, and you poke on them, and they go out. So this was more efficient.
The nice things about plants is they keep developing new organs. So I mean, you can look at new leaves from the beginning.
Yes.
Try that. Or
so at the beginning, that's what we wanted to do. But then we didn't have plants at the right stage or with enough like true leaves coming out. Or, I mean, at one point of the project, the first week, we decided to focus on cotyledons more to be more consistent. But yeah, that was, and I think it's interesting. It would be interesting to compare those data to what happened with true leaves. So here, the samples are actually fixed and stained with a dye. To look at only the cell membrane, plasma membrane. So if I show you a closer look of these embryos, we can actually, we were able to spot, by eyes, asymmetric division. And so we spotted them in activated seeds, but also all until up the Hertz stage. So here you see one asymmetric division. So asymmetric in size, I mean. And so we could see small cells that were produced. Of course, here we had mute, so we knew they were stomata precursors, but here we couldn't have mute. And so we were not sure if these cells were these ones. Are they the same or is it different? One way to address this question was actually to look at the neighboring configuration of those little cells. And so we did quantify a number of neighbors around little cells in this dormant, activated, or seedling. And you can see very clearly that the peak of the distribution for dormant and activated is 4, number of neighbors, and the one for seedling is 3. If we calculate only, if we look at only the cells, the small cells that have mute, so we had the data for activated and seedling only, you see the same thing. Peak is at 4 for activated, and here peak is at 3. So how come? Why do we have this difference in geometry? Well, if you remember what Wundt said, in the true leaves or in the growing cotyledons, you do have those spirally shape because the stomata's precursors will undergo successive division, asymmetric division. And so you will actually have specific neighborhood topology, which is actually known to be 3 neighbors on average. In our case, those cells, little cells, have 4 neighbors. So we hypothesized here that maybe what happened is like these cells undergo only one asymmetric division and not successive asymmetric divisions, and they will right away commit already in this stage. So in both contexts, it seemed that you form stomata like precursors in different ways. You can imagine that here, in this context, it's not coupled to growth. And in this context, it is, because the cells will divide a couple of times and produce pavement cells, and not here. I don't know if this is clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is the, how does cell number change between the, say across the cotyledon in the left sample and in the mature cotyledon, and how does that impact?
So I think that maybe these are two different mechanisms, and you can actually apparently spot this type of topology in the growing leaves, but at a very low rate. And so maybe those two mechanisms are in play in the growing leaves. But on top of that, you add those successive divisions. So I would I would argue that it's two ways of making the lineage.
So I thought there was two striking, quite a complete ignorance, two striking aspects of a Winslow illustration with the spiral. One is that since stomata differentiation is kind of terminal, it sort of means that if you start with a cell, it goes through its asymmetric division, and then eventually, only one of members of the lineage will actually produce it. Right? So ultimately, the number of stomata then is equal to the number of cells that enter this process. So,
yes.
if you count the cells in cotyledon, is it more or less the number of stomata in mature leaf?
Are there other mechanisms that I didn't mention? So the pavement cells sometimes can start expressing speechless, and then it'll just asymmetrically divide, and then it'll give rise to another little brown bird cell.
Also, on top of that, after the plant germinates, then you actually have, on top of this pre-pattern that is already there, initiation of other events that are more of the spiral.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understood.
Cotyledons are a bit weird, right? They're sort of done. It's a very special embryonic leaf, and are they down dividing except for stomata? Lineage,
so
this front of the moving, cell cycle.
Do they do that?
So do cells that are not stomatal cells divide again in the cotyledon infrequently? I would say fewer than 10%, but I don't know exactly.
Sorry, and you may answer this later, but one thing that's really distinct about these two images is the shape of the pavement cells. And that could be an autonomous event, or it could be associated with the cell divisions in the stomata lineages.
Exactly, don't do that later.
Sorry.
Yeah, we were happy with these results, but still yet we were wondering, but what's the molecular mechanism for this type of asymmetric division? Is it the same as what's known here, which is speechless that drive this asymmetric division? So thanks to, Anne Vatatten from Dominique's lab, we could have those two images where you have a wild-type activated seed, so it's just after germination seed, or
It's actually peeled out of the dormant seed.
You have the dormant seed, you can spot by eyes. We didn't have time to quantify this, but we could spot by eyes some asymmetric division. And in the speechless mutant, so that won't form any stomata, so that's known. And we actually don't see, we think, qualitatively by eyes, this pattern. So this might suggest that speechless also play a role very early on in development to pattern this stomata. And you can think that maybe when the seed goes out of dormancy, it needs stomata quite fast, it needs to produce. So this would be a way maybe to start the lineage early once you go out of the dormancy. And so, then all of these results raised quite a lot of questions among us, so we had this very nice discussion that Yaro will tell you about.
Thank you. Yes, so as Laura introduced, we see these small cells, which will eventually switch on mute. So that is an indication for us that they will commit eventually to the stomatal lineage or to the stomatal fate itself. And we also know that the speechless expression is actually required to make this asymmetry. So now, one way to think of this is actually that what might be happening here is that this division sort of resembles the last division of the spiral where the asymmetric cell, the small cell, then commits. But what is even more interesting, if you think, that you get this pattern in the developing embryo, and then the seed eventually matures and dries out, and in some plants can last remarkably long for thousands of years. In Arabidopsis, probably dozens of years. And then when it gets water and germinates, these cells eventually, which were generated a long time ago, will switch on mute and become stomata. And now the question is, how do they do that? So one possible explanation is that they get sort of molecularly primed already in the embryo, and then somehow remember this fate, let's say, by having specific proteins or RNAs already present there. On the other hand, as already suggested by previous speakers, there is probably something special about the last division that makes the cell commit. And there is actually work in Dominic's lab to test whether this might be the size of the cell. So this raises an interesting possibility that this cell might not need to remember what is it, but it rather senses it afterwards. So another suggestion would be that what happens is that the cell senses that it's small compared to its neighbors, and this is the signal that then turns on mute later. And of course, if we had two more years to investigate this, that would be the most interesting future directions to take. So, since one sees that speechless is important for this process, and there is indeed expression of speechless in the embryo, what we would really like to know is, once this embryo germinates, what are the cells that had speechless long time ago? So ideally, one would want some sort of, let's say, recombinase-driven system where these cells could be somehow tagged and visualized later on. And then we can ask, okay, what is the post-germination fate of these embryonic speechless positive cells? And eventually coming to the point of the remembering the fate versus sensing it, one could think of an experiment where actually we eventually artificially induce in the seed some asymmetric divisions in the speechless mutant background and ask whether this can sort of rescue the phenotype, which would argue that it does not need to be remembered. And another interesting point which was already raised is the geometry of the tissue. This is a bit pixelated, but I hope you can still see it. So looking at this pattern, what it kind of resembles is how stomata are actually patterned in grasses. So they come in these files of cells where the principal decision is, do we divide or we don't divide? And that would be an easy way to actually achieve this sort of four neighbor structure, if you think about it. And also, if you, I'll have to go back, if you look at the cotyledon itself, it already has this file of cells-like structure, so that might be suggesting that actually the patterning mechanism in the cotyledon would be something more similar to what's going on in monocotyledonous plants. So this was the part of pattern emergence and looking at what the pattern is doing by itself. And we also wanted to perturb the system, and for which we chose mainly to focus on mechanics, as was already pointed out in the course of these 5 weeks many times. Plant biologists were actually the first to suggest mechanical cues could play a role in the cell's behavior. So, for example, here is slide from what Dominic showed already, that by stretching the leaf, you can influence the distribution of polarity markers in cells. Also, what we've seen several times by now is that applying forces can reorient microtubules in plant cells. And another example, so this is a trichome of a Venus flytrap, where it suggested that the division pattern is driven by tension. So we had several markers that we and several fates that we wanted to assess. So we have plants with microtubule markers, and the initial idea was actually also to use this as a kind of calibration, so we can see how much do we need to stretch for the microtubules to do something, and then use this level of stretching to apply in our later experiments. Unfortunately, the imaging didn't work very well, so we had to resort to more or less arbitrary levels. Then another thing one could look at, as I mentioned already, is cell polarity. Then obviously cell fate decisions, because one would want to know whether all these changes that we can observe, are they actually somehow informative for what the cells do? And then, of course, coupled to that, cell division and growth. So the system works like this. So we take a seedling and apply medical adhesive on the cotyledons. Then we basically glue it on a sheet of PDMS, which is a stretchy polymer. And when the seedling is stuck there, we stretch and hold the polymer and then image. And for this, we actually got a great help from Sebastian, who developed the torture device for cells that we adapted for plants. And as I already mentioned, we were attempting to actually image microtubules live, which didn't work. So then we basically used a very coarse metric for stretching that was increasing the length of the PDMS stripe by 50%. Nevertheless, we quantified the cell division orientations. So in this case, we stretch along the longer axis of the leaf, and we also measure the angle of the newly added cell wall relative to that. And as is probably pretty obvious from these pictures, with this applied level of stretching, not much happens. One has to also know that maybe the stretching was actually a bit too high, because the observed area that we had was the same. And even though having more cotyledons in this case, we actually observed less division. So maybe the cells were stressed and not that happy. Another interesting...
Is there a control in here, or is it just glued onto the PDMS?
Yes, so the control here is glued on after we stretched. Yes, exactly.
These seedlings were at the same stage that was published previously?
Yes, so that was basically 3 days post-germination. Yeah.
How much did you stretch? Is it a bit comparable to growth? Like,
yeah, that's exactly what we don't know. So, as I said, initially we wanted to use the microtubules as a sort of proxy for what is the relevant stretching, but since we couldn't get this, we really just went with arbitrary stretching.
So the area of the cotyledon increased by how much?
By around, I would say, 10 to 20%. That's a lot. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And as I said, also this indicates that probably we stressed them a bit too much. But unfortunately, they still divided. Yeah, that's true. They still divided. So they were not completely dead. That's for sure. And also because for this stretching movies, we actually use time lapse with a finer time resolution than for other experiments, what we noticed were some interesting events, such as this one cell, which was found in a stretched cotyledon, but this context, I believe it probably is not very indicative, but it's just to illustrate that the dynamics of mute, which is supposed to mark cell that is committed to become a stomata, is very interesting here. So as you see with the quantification, what happens in the cell is that it actually loses mute expression and then it reacquires it. With this, I'm heading to the future directions. And as you might have thought by now, other sort of problem or challenge that we always have to think of when doing these stretching experiments is the morphology and anatomy of the plant itself. So we apply the adhesive and we would like to think of the leaf as a sort of flat sheet, but in fact it has different sort of surface bumps and corrugations, which of course affect how our leaf adheres. Sometimes the leaf is a bit cup-shaped, and then when we put the cover slip on, we see that it breaks at the edges. And then also, ultimately, we glue the top epidermis to the stretchy membrane, but what we observe is the bottom epidermis, and their anatomical connection is sort of non-trivial. So you have this layer of palisade cells under the top epidermis, and then the so-called spongy mesophyll that is kind of loosely connected cells. So this adds another level of complication to actually interpreting these results. And as already pointed out, what we would like to have with this setup, if we wanted to develop it further, would be to have control not only of how much we stretch, but also how fast we stretch, because at the moment it's basically someone turning the screwdriver. And with an adjusted setup like that, one could think of asking questions such as, does it matter in which direction you apply the stretching? So we only stretched with the long axis of the leaf, and actually with the paper that was already published from Dominic's lab, it was the stretching with the shorter axis of the leaf. And then one could also imagine trying to perturb just locally, so gluing only a part of the leaf and then stretching and looking at whether this has any organ-wide effects. And with that, I would finish and thank all the people involved, especially our fearless leaders, Dominic and Dirk, who were really a lot of fun to work with and discuss. Sebastian for the help with the stretching device and microscopy setup. And if we heard earlier about magical creatures appearing to help, then we have another one, which is Dylan, who would always appear in the evening to help us with the analysis. Then Paul, who, as you've heard, provided insights and reagents for the embryo staining, and Ruth from UCSB, whose facilities actually the plants were cultured. And of course, thank you for your attention. And if you have more questions, then I'm happy to answer.
So your theory, hypothesis right now is stomata patterning machinery, like molecular mechanism, is conserved even between monocots and dicots. And it's about how like tissue is giving the mechanical cues and the division patterns that determines.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an expert on stomatal patterning, but as far as I know, the transcription factors are conserved. And it's actually kind of interesting to think of whether this is sort of the ancestral or easy mechanism that you have for the cotyledons, that let's say you need just create some pattern quickly so that you have stomata directly after you germinate, whether this might be something that actually the plants kind of detoured back to the monocots.
thank you all for sticking around. We're Team Meristem. We are also Team SW Squared. And we also noticed, actually, that if you flip that, it's an S for Meristem, which is kind of fun. So today we'll be telling you about our investigation into the mechanical regulation of auxin signaling in shoot apical meristems. And we have a little bonus feature, which is building a light shoot microscope. So as we've grown to appreciate, at least as an animal biologist, that plants have this really striking pattern, and thought that this pattern is really important for organ development and function. And so we did a little bit of finding meristems in the wild. And so here I'm dissecting this, but I think it's a really nice representation of how you get this nice phyllotaxis in plants. And so, like I said, this is important for function. And this patterning is thought, pardon me, this patterning is regulated at the level of the shoot apical meristem, which you're seeing here. And so then these primordia emerge in this phyllotactic pattern, so P0, P1, P2. And of course, we use Arabidopsis to study this. And so a long-standing question in the field is basically how these primordia are patterned in this manner. And so what is regulating this spacing? And so we know from some of the talks earlier that auxin and PIN1 are very critical for regulating this process. And so we actually have a couple of tools to observe auxin-mediated transcriptional activity. And so this is what you're seeing here. And as we learned, we don't actually have a reporter for auxin itself. We actually just have these transcriptional reporters in which you have an auxin-responsive element, and a transcription factor binds when auxin is high. And then you get expression of a GFP. And then we also have a PIN1 reporter, but this is actually indicating more of the endogenous level of the protein. So you have a promoter for a PIN1 that's expressing a GFP tagged PIN1 here. We didn't get time to look at PIN1, but we do have some nice auxin transcriptional reporter data that we'll go through today. And so the combination of these tools, as well as many others, have shown a little bit about how auxin transport is directed. And so from that work, two potential hypotheses have emerged. One basically is that auxin flux dictates PIN polarization. And so where auxin flux is highest, you get PIN preferentially polarized to the other side of the cell, or to these neighboring cells. And there's also this concentration-based hypothesis in which auxin concentration is high. This results in loosening the cell wall, and then you get more stress on your neighboring cells. This stress then polarizes PIN1 in these neighboring cells, and then you get auxin transport into these cells. And so then this feedback loop generates an auxin maxima, and then you get subsequent cell wall loosening and outgrowth of the primordia. And so this will be the model we're focusing on primarily for our talk, because we're really interested in the mechanics of what's happening here. And as I mentioned, there's some really nice mechanical data that's been looked at with cortical microtubule patterning or alignment here, as well as PIN1 polarity. But of course, this is all happening in lieu of cell division and cell elongation, so there's many mechanical and physical parameters that are changing during morphogenesis. And so what we really wanted to do was look at how these physical and mechanical inputs are actually being translated over the course of development of the new primordia. And so this led us to ask the central question, which is, can we predict the site of primordia initiation by asking for physical changes in the shoot apical meristem? And so we have a couple of mutants, actually, that have very obvious differences in their curvature of their apical, or their shoot apical meristem. And so this is the wild type you're seeing here. And so it's slightly curved. This is a mutant that has a very high curvature, and a mutant that has a relatively flat apical meristem. And so the question was, if we're changing the tissue geometry, what are we seeing in auxin regulation? And so the two physical parameters that we wanted to assay were curvature and stress, and Shino's going to take you through that.
First, I would like to briefly explain why curvature and stress will be interesting to us. So for curvature, Susie has mentioned that we have two mutant and wild type that has very different tissue surface curvature, which is not shown here. But what we are interested in, we think we can use a curvature to predict if the primordia is initiated in star outgrowth. As you can see here, at the tip of this primordial, the Gaussian curvature will be a positive. And in these folds that is forming, we are supposed to see a Gaussian curvature that is negative. And in contrast to the tissue level curvature, we are also think that cell level surface curvature will be also interesting to look into. As Susie also mentioned briefly, if we have oxygen maxima here, the cell wall will be softened. So if we look at the top surface that is facing out of the tissue, we should be able to see a convex surface if the wall is soft. So the second is stress. So stress field can be used to infer the cell polarity, as has been used in many studies. As you can see that it can either be because of the microtubule polarization, the mechanical property will be polarized, and the cell elongation and cell division will also change the polarity of the cells. So we believe stress can give us some information about the cell polarity. And regarding to the oxygen transports, we know that PIN1 concentrates towards a cell wall that with highest stress, and also oxygen signaling and the primordial growth may redistribute the stress. So we can use this information to see how the mechanics will regulate the oxygen transport as a feedback feedback mechanism. To start with, we will look into the wild type primordium here. This is one of the. This is a 3D view of one of these primordial. These are two big flower buds. So if we calculate the Gaussian curvature and project it into using the conformal mapping onto these 2D, we use IMSE that is developed by Sebastian Essi, and also Nola and Dylan help us a lot to get the data. So I just realized, like in the first talk, that the grid size or the grain size I use will emphasize the cell curvature instead of the tissue curvature. So you can see these are the very deep folds here and here. So we see it's alternating of the positive and negative curvature. It's maybe just an artifact from the data analysis, but it's very well aligned where the large primordials are. And what I wanted to bring you to attention is this area. So we see a lot of positive curvature inside the cells on top of the cell surface, and a little bit of negative curvature on these cell junctions. So it's likely the cell has this convex surface, and the cell wall is kind of pinching it down into the tissue. So if we look at one of the Z-step, so these are the cells inside the primordial. I don't know which layer, probably from the peripheral, but these are the cell that is on the top surface. Maybe equivalent to L1, you see that this surface has this convex surface.
And that's always at the length scale of one cell, roughly, or is this multiple cells where you get this convex surface?
I think the resolution or the scale I put is like we only see this.
We should be able to see
if we kind of smooth the data. Yeah, we put a lot to capture the surface of the details.
Sebastian, I'm sorry, are you referring to the fact that it kind of looks like every other cell?
Yeah, I think it looks like every other, right? So you could think that this is clonal or something, right? That
yeah,
if you're related,
it goes to the new cell divisions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That they get pinched back with is a periclonal wall. So they bulge out from the edges, but they come back wherever there's a wall.
But here it's like
cell. So it's basically the new cells then that are weak. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if a cell, a parental cell starts like that, and so then a new wall is inserted, so I guess it would start like that, but then a lot of it grow, and over time, that wall would become limiting and anchor the surface wall.
What about these guys that just divided? And the one in the internal, that's really elongated. That's probably vascular. It's going to become
maybe.
Okay, so what we speculated earlier is like it's either a weakening of the wall or the cell volume become bigger, so it's kind of having this convex surface. Mm-hmm. So then we also get the stress pattern using force inference developed by Nick. He also helped a lot to get these stress fields. Let's see what other. To start with, so first explain how we look at the stress field. So these are a lot of ellipses here. So the major and the minor axis is proportional to the principal stress at these.
So, how did you get stresses? I didn't
get that. Oh, we use a. Are we going to? So we use a force inference. So basically, if you have a. How to draw that? So if you have cells, we think that on each vertex, the junctional tension should be balanced on each one. So you can do this force balance across the whole tissue to get infer how much, like a relative number of the junctional tension. So if you know the junctional tension, you can use a finite, what is that called? Solid mechanics to get what is the stress field inside the cells. So if it is ellipse like this, the stress field is like more like this direction. If we see a large circle, so it's more likely to be an isotropic. And if we see a small circle, as probably we can see here, this may be like this. So this may infer that it's at this, that point is at very low tension.
So, I mean, it's like the cell's elongated in this direction.
Oh, so this is the top surface.
Right. How do you know it's not being compressed?
I think we didn't consider about that in this.
The idea is just that each vertex is at equilibrium, or quasi-equilibrium. That's all that's important.
No, but you don't know whether it's compressed in three different ways.
It assumes the system is planar.
It works with a soapy tissue. Situation, soapy-like situation, but these guys are not quite.
If the wall can also be inserted at whatever angle all of a sudden, which may not represent, so it doesn't have to represent like an elastic equilibrium kind of thing, it's just whatever. Nice thought.
I suppose like a nice confirmation too, if this is actually a biologically relevant readout would be looking at like the microtubule.
That would be, that's true.
Or laser ablation experiments.
Yeah. Just to confirm that we're not getting some sort of noise in the system.
I mean, if you're interested in learning about this more, we can talk about it offline, but you know, there are ways how you can test whether these hypotheses apply based on the geometry of the cells, you know, and we just fail to have enough time to provide, you know, assessment.
There's also anisotropy in the cell properties, and so it's not uniform mechanical properties, and so the stresses therefore may not represent strain or.
Well, so strictly speaking, you don't assume any uniformity of mechanical properties, right? No. So you just assume mechanical equilibrium, and you assume that the stresses, for whatever reason, are concentrated in the edges, right? So you basically say that there is tension in each edge, could be different from one edge to another, and there is, if you like, Tugger pressure inside the cell, right? And then the geometry takes care of the rest, and the assumption of force balance. Okay. Now, of course, it makes more sense for animal cells, which are not made out of wood,
right?
Because these things don't just have tension, they have rigidity, right? And so you can run an algorithm and which will generate inference based on these assumptions, but you also have to test whether the assumptions apply in this case. And so as far as I know, this is sort of the first time that anybody tried to look at the geometry of the meristem in that level of, well, with all the assumptions.
It might be worth comparing to the stresses predicted. Assuming that it's the pressurized shell, because I think it looks quite different to that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is very different. It doesn't assume that you're deforming a rigid elastic body. Not at all.
Okay.
By the way, guys, where is the meristem? So there is the meristem proper, the stem cell population. So there is I1, I2, so that's incipient primordia, and then primordia 1, 2. So where is the sort of the center, the central zone, if you will?
Oh, the I1 should be here. Sorry.
Okay. So where I1 is there.
Yeah,
I1
should be like.
I tried to enlarge it, so probably I forgot.
Yeah.
So for the identify, like Paul told us, start with the largest one and follow the phyrotaxis. So it's 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and I2. And I1 is a future one that is in the time lapse, we can see the oxygen move to that area. We have a next slide is better.
Sorry, but it's interesting with your prediction of the stress, and meristem proper has the directionality. That's interesting because the other model doesn't have, and that kind of thing will be interesting to compare.
And we noticed that like it seems like each primordial has a kind of territory. You can see I2 has this area, P2 is this, P3 is here, and P1 is here, P4 is here. So if we look closely, put in the I2 area, we see that the cell, the stress field is very much polarized, and this is belongs to P3. So it's like a polarity is shifted, have a pretty hard boundary somewhere here. And P1, very much polarized, and also P2 polarized. So if we also take time lapse over like 24 hours in 6 hours per frame, and this probably is not the most optimized growth, so it's getting a little bit slower. So we see this P4 and P5 and P3 become bigger. And what interesting is you also see the polarized stress field become less polarized. It's consistent here and here. So this is see the higher surface curvature in the area that is primordial is outgrowing here, and also here. But unfortunately, we wanted to use it to capture this, but the parameter I picked cannot do that now. So if we have a closer look at the stress pattern, so P2, sorry. I1 is a new area that may initiate the primordial growth, and I2 is the one that is a little bit older. We see that the polarized stress become less polarized. And also for the P1 that is a little bit older than I2, so in this area, it's also getting more isotropic like. So Henrik has a model paper showing that the switch from anisotropic to isotropic material is required for the tissue growth. So we think it's very interesting to see this kind of, but it's a little bit confusing. The things can, like, this is older than this, but this is more polarized than this. So we don't have any statistical analysis to show what is going on here, but I think it's very interesting observation to share. So we also look at the WASH7 mutant, which is crazy growing. I have a very bad time to identify which one is which. So because this area is very close to the center of the meristem, like, what's going on? But we figured out that this is P10, P9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then I3, I2, I1. In the time lapse, this oxygen will be transported and enriched in these three areas. So we also know that there's no such like defined territory in the stress fields. So we don't know anything what's wrong. So we just have a hypothesis that maybe we can test, because in the Washoe, the growth, cell growth and the differentiation is uncontrolled and very fast. So these cells may have very limited time to remodel the wall or redistributive stresses, so we don't see a very clear what's going on here.
So you know how initially we were wondering if the blue spots were the result. So on your curvature diagram, the blue cells were probably the recently divided cells. do you have a curvature diagram for this one? And does it look like there's more blue compared to yellow?
Let me see. I don't. How to mirror that? We don't have time to process this. It's a file. So I don't see a lot of blue cells. Okay. I see a lot of yellow cells. Yeah. And this is supposed to be a very flat surface, as here. Mm. And the scale we choose cannot tell anything from. So last is we also take a look of this, say the name?
Lonely guy.
Lonely guy, Newton. So the meristem is tiny, small, and with two flower buds. And we don't, with the time frame we pick every 6 hours, we don't see any enrichment of auxin in the meristem area. So it could be a problem we need to solve in the later. So some future direction, so straightforward, we want to analyze more wild-type Borscht-7 and lonely guy mutants. And in a better way, I mean, we need to understand the method better, and so we can extract the information we need from the data. We also want to correlate with the PIN1 localization, because the current auxin reporter is based on, it's an indirect reporter. So if we know more information about PIN1 localization, we should get a better clue of the dynamic process. So this is, we have the line, but it's kind of overexposed maybe. I can see a lot of polarization with an experienced eyes. So as a short conclusion, we think this process is very dynamic. So P1 has auxin enriched, and it will slowly, it will transport it to this I1 area, which will initiate the primordial growth. And in this stage, we see the cell stress field is very anisotropic. But when the auxin at the maximum, the cells become less isotropic. And then the auxin level will also reduce, and the primordial start outgrowing, and they become anisotropic again. And after a while, it become more like a sphere-like, it will become isotropic. So with the time, because we only take one frame per 6 hours, we definitely miss a lot of processes. So I think timing is important for us to capture all of these dynamic behaviors and try to correlate the auxin transcription, auxin transports, with any physical properties that may tell us how the mechanics is regulated by the auxin level. But if we image them every 2 hours, the plant will be very much stressed. So we have a solution, is to build a light sheet. Also, there's one limitation. Not a lot of lab has the upright microscope. So put a light sheet instead.
All right, so I won't go through this in too much detail, because we already had a very nice explanation of the basic principles and features of a light sheet. But essentially, you have excitation of your sample perpendicular to your detection. And the advantages of light sheet microscopy is that it's supposed to minimize phototoxicity of your sample, and you are able to get better penetration of scattering tissues. So this is our light sheet, and you can see some very high-tech technology. And it's a light shielding apparatus here, and some high-tech adhesive. So the first thing that we did was build the illumination arm, and so this requires aligning your light so that you align them to the galvomirrors, which allow you to move the light. And so the galvomirrors, you can't see them, they're actually in this scanner, and they will rotate, and this will then move the light. And so there's the scanning lens, which will rotate like this, and you'll move the light in this direction. So after we get the scanner set up, we direct the light toward our sample chamber, and this gives you a Gaussian beam generated in the sample chamber. We detect the beam using our observation objective and then our camera back here. And so this is our observation objective back here. And with our camera, we can take a picture of this beam. And so it's important to also build this second arm, illumination arm. You can see some poorly aligned beams here from the second arm. So woo, we've made a light sheet, except, well, almost. We need to be able to actually move the beam. And so we generate the light sheet by scanning rapidly by moving the galvomir. And so this is just the slow scan. So this wouldn't create a sheet, but a rapid scan will. And so then you get a sheet. And this is just a picture. And this is the light sheet on, or looking at visualizing with our camera and our computer. And so we were actually able to take a really cool image. This is actually a reporter, a transcriptional reporter for Wushel, which was one of the mutants that we showed earlier in the presentation. And it's concentrated in the organizing center of the meristem. And so you can see it's not labeling like the outer side of the meristem, but it's very concentrated here as well as in the primordia and the flower bud. So success, we did it. So we have some aspirational improvements. One would be to rotate the sample. Another would be to decrease the degrees of freedom. We often had to adjust the light so that it was aligned properly. Faster stage and potentially an optical table if we get a lot of money. And so this is, I don't know if that title is. This was actually, I don't know if this will, it's fine. You guys saw it. So we have a lot of people to thank. these are everyone doing their meristem impressions. So I'd like to thank our TAs, Ting and Paul, as well as Elliot for his support on this project and letting us use a bunch of plants because we brutally dissected some very early on. Our force inference crew, as well as Noah helping with the curvature. So thanks to Dylan and Nick and Boris. Sebastian was kind enough to take us through building the light sheet. it was a lot of fun, really. And Dirk for answering all of our plant-related questions late Thursday. So thank you all. Any outstanding questions, or do people want to?
It's one. Everybody is hungry.
Yeah. It's okay, we can talk at lunch if needed.
Well, thank you, everybody.
So do we meet at 2 in the lab for finishing up? Yeah. Is that okay? 2 o'clock in the lab?
I think so.
Great.
Third round of experiments.
Yeah, there are some outstanding issues, I believe.
Sorry.
And 5 o'clock at the residence for the last barbecue. That sounds very good.